most women rely on their family for support. But some expect too much from their own flesh and blood. Yeah. A greedy woman drags two teenagers into darkness.
She had to involve her son and an innocent girl.
I don't know what she's talking about.
A manipulative mother betrays her firstborn.
She's basically trying to throw her own daughter under the bus.
I need to talk to my old boss, Sharky.
And sisterly love solves a messy divorce.
Even if he cried out, even if he had the strength to cry out, there was no one to hear him.
These deadly women prove blood is thicker than water when they enlist their killer kin. A doting mother.
You don't love my son, I don't love you.
Teaches her lover.
He did not know that was happening.
That nothing can sever family ties.
I can't even begin to imagine the horror that he must have felt.
In 2009, 45-year-old Denise Fry is living out her dream, running a cafe that's become the throbbing social hub of Marengo, Iowa.
Hi, Joe. How are things?
Good, Denise. Keeping busy?
Always.
She had a lot of friends.
How's the lasagna?
A lot of people that not only work for her, but just general friends.
It's all thanks to her boyfriend, 33-year-old Curtis Bailey. He bought the cafe to keep his sweetheart happy.
All the better for seeing you.
For people who knew the couple, they thought they were very good together. Actually, very sweet with one another.
I need help with the dishes.
Curtis and Denise have been lovers for 5 years. But there's one thing muddying the waters. Denise's 19-year-old son, Jacob.
Jacob was a young man who was quite content sitting around watching TV and hanging out with his friends. Curtis Bailey is probably one of the hardest working people that I ever knew. So I think naturally there was some strain between the two because of their differences.
Did you take any money out of my wallet?
That strain reaches the breaking point when money goes missing.
Jacob, did you take it?
Of course he didn't.
Denise is forced to divide her loyalties.
That money could have fallen out of your pocket.
I don't think so.
Laziness and now lying. It's the last straw for Curtis.
Get your things and go.
He kicks Jacob out of his house and out of their everyday lives.
Curtis was very outspoken that he didn't like Jacob and banned him from not only their home, but from the cafe as well. I think this probably had a profound effect on Denise more than Jacob.
Instead of biding by her boyfriend's wishes, Denise begins a life of deception, sneaking her son into the cafe.
Denise did what she could to kind of work around the fact that those two were never going to get along.
You'll be here soon.
Jacob's still enjoying plenty of attention from his doting mom and from Denise's waitress, 19-year-old Jessica Dayton.
Jessica Dayton was friends with Jacob Hilgendorf, and I guess actually they both described their relationship as friends with benefit.
Denise knows this subterfuge can't last forever.
Go.
The only way to make it stop is to cut one person out of the picture.
Okay. Hi, how was your day?
And for Denise, blood is thicker than water.
She was probably angry at him for not accepting her son. So There was a little revenge in there. You don't love my son, I don't love you.
The overworked cafe owner is also hoping for a better payday.
I think Denise liked a lifestyle that she couldn't have. I think she wanted to live a little higher on the hog, so to speak.
As a construction foreman, Curtis is well off. He also has a life insurance policy worth $100,000.
If she could get Curtis out of the way, she could have money, she could spend it the way she wanted, she could have her son back in the house, and she wouldn't have to work so hard.
Denise doesn't want any blood on her hands, so she tries the subtle approach.
Curtis was somebody who was known to enjoy beer and drank a lot of beer. And Denise was somebody who is very well versed in drugs, not only over-the-counter drugs, but prescription drugs. She had access to diabetic medication, insulin syringes, and she had, on more than one occasion, injected Curtis with insulin when he was intoxicated, trying to get him to die of a reaction to the insulin.
But the plan doesn't work. Instead of slipping away quietly, Curtis wakes in fright.
He did not know that was happening. He thought there was something wrong with his heart.
I need to go to the hospital. It hurts jumping out of my chest.
After those attempts, she decided that she would have to do it another way.
This time, Denise calls in reinforcements and invents a story to help her cause.
She told a lot of stories about how Curtis was abusive, controlling.
She convinces her son Jacob and his girlfriend Jessica that Curtis Bailey is a sadistic monster.
He's hurting you. He has to pay.
Jacob would have his mom back to himself again, and he wouldn't have these restrictions of when he could see her. So Jacob's life and his mind would have been improved by Curtis going away.
I'm in.
I think Jessica got involved just solely because of Jacob. Either she was in love with him or thought she was in love with him.
The cafe queen even adds a little icing to the cake.
Denise Fry ends up offering $5,000 to both Jacob and Jessica to help murder Curtis.
It's nice.
All that's left is to invite Curtis to his own demise, and it must be something too good to resist.
Are you serious?
Curtis had no idea what was going to happen.
Oh, I love this.
A warm summer's night in Marengo, Iowa, 2009. Live-in lovers Denise Fry and Curtis Bailey are sharing more than just cuddles. They're sharing a secret.
Are you serious?
Denise has made her boyfriend a tantalizing offer.
Curtis had no idea what was going to happen. In fact, when he went to work that day, he was happy.
Curtis is bursting to tell someone the news.
Well, Kurt wasn't supposed to tell anybody. He wasn't able to keep it in, so he told his boss what was supposed to happen.
I'm not meant to tell.
It was a menage a trois between Denise and a girl named Jessica.
Denise has organized a three-way.
What Curtis doesn't know is that Denise is luring her lover to his death, using her son's 19-year-old girlfriend, Jessica, as bait.
It wasn't enough for Denise to kill someone that she hated. She had to involve her son and an innocent girl.
Curtis was familiar with Jessica and was very excited, apparently, to be able to have this little party with the two.
Remember the rules?
The women have strict rules for their sexy game.
If they did something of sexual nature, Kurt was to do a shot of hard liquor.
They want him to drink himself into a stupor.
Once the party started between Denise and Jessica, he did get quite intoxicated, had taken quite a few shots.
Just when things start to heat up, Curtis passes out, all according to plan.
Once Curtis passes out, Jessica texts Jacob to come over.
Denise was definitely the main player, the mastermind. Jacob and Jessica's role was to assist.
Denise wants the death to look like natural causes.
Denise came up with the idea that she could wrap his face in plastic wrap and smother him and kill him without leaving any marks.
That wouldn't be obvious that somebody was actually involved in a homicide, but it looked like it was a natural death.
Everything goes smoothly until Curtis comes to.
When Curtis wakes up and sees that his wife is basically standing over him along with her son and her son's friend, I can't even begin to imagine the horror that he must have felt. At what in the world is going on here? Curtis was gasping for air and started to fight back.
The trio starts clutching at straws.
They just started to grab anything within reach and started to beat Curtis with it.
An ashtray, a candy dish, anything that was around in the house that they could use. It didn't seem to be working at first, so I guess they kept hitting him over and over again.
They knew they wanted to kill him. They just didn't know how to do it. Basically, what it turned into was a Keystone Cops murder.
With three people attacking him and the number of blows to his head, it was over fairly quickly.
With up to 30 blows to his head, Curtis Bailey is dead. His killers now have a problem.
We've got a very bloody, beaten body. There's no way she can call 911 and say her husband just had a heart attack. That's just not going to work anymore. There was an attempt by the three to clean up the house, but there was just no way that was going to happen.
It's not working. Okay, we put everything in the bag.
So eventually, Denise gets Jacob and Jessica to leave the house.
Denise concocts an alibi, then calls the police.
My boyfriend's been murdered.
A story that Mexican drug dealers had come into the house and got into a fight with Curtis, and it ended up in Curtis being beaten to death.
I heard noises.
But detectives discover the blood is already congealed. Curtis was dead long before Denise says he was murdered.
The police didn't believe it. I don't believe at all. They knew that something else had happened, and I think especially because there was so much blood and blood was all over her.
Denise and the two teenagers are questioned. Then police search Jacob's car and find bags of bloody rags and blood-stained clothes. The matriarch still pleads innocent until her son decides to take the rap.
Denise started to get worried that Jacob was confessing to it, so she started to confess to the crime, saying that she had to kill Curtis because he was so mean to her, and that it really isn't the fault of Jacob or Jessica because they were only there to help her.
The juries don't believe her. In January 2011, Jessica Dayton and Jacob Hilgendorf are both convicted of first-degree murder. Denise Fry is also convicted of murder. All three are sentenced to life with no chance of parole.
Blood really is thicker than water, and this murder proves it.
Denise Fry destroyed her devoted lover so she could reunite with her son. Instead, they will spend their lives apart.
Basically, not only did she end the life of her victim, but really ended the life of the two teenagers. They will die in prison. Their lives lasted 18, 19 years, and that's it. They're done.
They're all serving life sentences because Denise is a selfish woman.
Some daughters will do anything for mom.
Her mom taught her everything she knew.
And that's not always a good idea.
We just knew in our heart of hearts that she did that. I was shocked.
Something was wrong with this picture.
In the late 1990s, in Hawthorne, Florida.
Scribble competition.
It's another school day. But 6-year-old Guinevere doesn't have to catch a bus. Her 27-year-old mom, Stephanie, homeschools her, while her husband, Bill, is away working for weeks.
He had a lot of jobs where he would have to go out of state sometimes and work.
Who's a happy girl?
Me. The younger years of their marriage, he was gone a lot.
That means mom and daughter live in their own little world.
Quinn basically was brought up being homeschooled and not really having too much interaction outside of the house with her mom.
After 10 years, the arrangement turns sour.
Did you pay those bills I sent the money for?
Bill has been sending his wages home to provide for the family.
I sent you the rent money.
But the money seems to disappear.
What are you accusing me of?
As sister-in-law Brenda Hudnall remembers.
He worked very hard for his family. He worked out of state in order to provide what he thought would be a good income for them. He'd come home and there would be no money. The bills wouldn't be paid.
Stephanie suffered from what I call the princess syndrome. She contributed nothing to their marriage or their life except misery.
By this time, Gwen is 17 and has a younger sister. And mom tells them it's all dad's fault.
Your father doesn't love us enough to keep a roof over our heads.
I sent you more than enough.
Stop blaming mom. It's not her fault.
She led them to believe that their father was abusive towards her, didn't want to take care of them, that he had money, he wouldn't help them with anything. Basically, put all of her thoughts in their mind.
There is no indication that Bill ever abused or neglected his children.
Stephanie isn't just indoctrinating the children against their father. She won't even let them help when he suffers a stroke in 2011.
Mom, something's wrong with Dad.
He had the stroke in their living room, and they sat there and watched him.
and the Pacers defeated the Mavericks.
Should we call 911?
No.
Stephanie refused to let them call 911.
Bill recovers, but now knows the danger he faces in his own house. He confides in his brother.
Tim, if anything ever happens to me, you'll take care of the children, won't you?
Bill said to my husband, if anything should happen to me, would you please promise me you'll take care of my children? And Tim said, of course I will. Bill, what's going on? He says, we'll talk later.
Bill decides to move out. He wants to end his marriage, but not the relationship with his children.
You can come visit anytime.
Bill wanted to stay in town so that he could see his children, whom he loved. But Bill had a mean and vicious spouse that was troubled.
Got it.
Stephanie continues to undermine him.
They would spend time with their dad and their mother would pick him up.
I miss you.
Love you, Daddy.
That they could not tell their dad they loved him in front of her because on the ride home, she would really give them a hard time.
I cannot believe you said you loved him after all he has done to us.
How can you tell him that you love him as awful as he is and really made them hate him?
He has to pay.
Stephanie is sowing the seeds for a permanent separation.
Bill should have left and stayed far, far away. Not living with Stephanie was the first step, but he didn't go far away enough.
2011, Hawthorne, Florida. For most of her life, 19-year-old Gwen Hudnall is under the control of her mother, Stephanie.
Okay. Great. I'll let you know. Thanks, Dad.
Now her father, Bill, is trying to break the unhealthy dependence.
You got me a job.
Guinevere was getting ready to go on this job with her dad.
You can't take it.
And Stephanie stopped her. I believe that was basically Stephanie trying to stop Guinevere from becoming self-sufficient, but still depending upon her.
Then Stephanie does something odd.
Maybe you'd like to stay over with your dad.
On June 9th, 2011,
that'd be love.
She ceases hostilities and allows Gwen to stay over at her dad's place for the first time in months. Little does Dad know his daughter is a Trojan horse for his vindictive wife.
She felt an obligation of some sort.
I'm going to turn in.
She did it to make her mother pleased with her.
Good night.
She waited for him to go to bed. She got the axe off the back porch, came around to his bedroom, and just started hitting him with the axe.
When his body was expiring, it made a noise, and it scared Guinevere. And so she continued to hit him till she knew that he was dead. And
Gwen decapitates her father.
There was blood everywhere. There was brain matter everywhere. Bone. It was pretty gruesome.
Although Gwen wields the pickaxe, it is all on Stephanie's command.
Stephanie Hudnall is a violent psychopath who manipulated her own daughter to murder
over the bed.
The next day,
blood.
Stephanie calls 911, pretending she's just found Bill's body.
I start interviewing Stephanie, and she was very emotional. It got to the point, it was so much, it was obvious that it was a put-on. It was too overly exaggerated emotion.
Detective Sandy Myers smells a rat, and so does Bill's family.
We were turning them all towards Stephanie because we just knew in our heart of hearts is that she did that. And the more we thought about it, the more we knew.
Did you kill your husband, Stephanie?
No.
Police interview both mother and daughter. They get a confession, but not the one they expect.
Mom, I told him the truth. I told him everything.
I was very surprised that it was Gwen that had actually done the act and not Stephanie.
I was shocked because I really truly did not believe that child could do that.
Guinevere gets a shock of her own.
I don't know what she's talking about.
She said, Mom, I told him. And Stephanie was acting like she didn't know what she was talking about.
Stephanie's already sacrificed her husband. Now she'll sacrifice her daughter.
She's basically trying to throw her own daughter under the bus.
At that moment, Guinevere became an emotional orphan.
Reality struck Guinevere right then, right there, that how could she lie like that? How could she do that to me?
Police discover Stephanie wanted her husband dead to receive his Social Security benefits. Betrayed in the cruelest way, Guinevere Hudnall stands trial for murder alongside her mother, Stephanie. In September 2012, both are convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to 40 years in prison.
Gwen truly wants nothing to do with Stephanie anymore after it was all said and done. She realized in the end that she had been manipulated. Obviously, by then it's too late.
Stephanie used her daughter as a weapon in her war against her husband.
I believe that she had been planning this for a very, very long time.
A common ploy of users and abusers, which is what Stephanie was, is to isolate their victims from their family, school, friends. And in a sense, Guinevere was Stephanie's victim.
This is an insult. I want 60% plus $1 million.
When a marriage crumbles,
that we're no longer living as man and wife,
a woman turns to her flesh and blood.
It was a family affair.
To solve all her problems.
It was cold, calculating, and done for financial benefit.
Tamworth, in rural New South Wales, Australia, is harsh, arid country. But in 2002, it's loved by 42-year-old cattle breeder Jeffrey Ryan and his wife, Helen.
Jeff sought out that particular property. It's good country, and it was a perfect spot for him to carry on his breeding business.
Helen's sister, Janine, and mother, Coralie, are welcome guests.
What do you really think of the house, Coralie?
I'm very impressed.
That's a nice piece of land, too.
Jeffrey and Helen are happy for 4 years. Until Mother Nature intervenes. Severe drought hits the land. And by 2006, the couple is close to bankruptcy.
Jeff was certainly under a lot of financial stress at this time. Australia was deep in a very severe rural drought. Within a couple of years, the cracks started to show in their relationship.
What?
Nothing. Just letting you know I've moved you into the spare room. No.
Helen is a fair-weather wife. When the money dries up, so does her love for Jeffrey.
They were no longer living as man and wife.
Helen shares her marriage woes with her sister, Janine.
Hello. Hey, Helen. Is everything all right?
And reveals a dark secret.
He's abusing me, sis.
Claiming Jeffrey is a wife beater.
Got to get it stopped.
She poured her heart out over the phone to Janine, telling her that Jeffrey was abusing her.
He wants everything his own way.
That he was hitting her. And that she really needed someone to talk to about it.
Just need some help.
Helen isn't telling the whole truth.
Oh, damn!
There is domestic violence, but Helen isn't the victim. She is the abuser.
She even physically attacked him and left him with very severe bruising across his chest and upper arms. He didn't like confrontation. In fact, it made him very nervous.
I think that Jeff was certainly afraid of her from time to time.
Jeff keeps the abuse secret. When he gets a job at a local chicken factory to supplement his income.
Oh, hi.
Is everything okay? You look terrible.
He meets a woman he can confide in.
Anything I can do?
She was just a friendly face that he felt that he could talk to.
Thanks so much. It'll work itself out, I'm sure.
Sharing the burden of what he was living with. It became something that Jeff relied on a lot.
Their friendship moves to the next level. They become lovers. But Helen isn't a woman willing to share her man, even one she doesn't want.
Helen couldn't accept that Jeff had found somebody else.
The couple no longer shares a bed, but Helen still visits.
Helen would often come into his room and sit on the end of his bed.
He would find her just staring at him.
Hey, what's happening?
I want you to make love to me.
What? She would badger him for sex.
Oh, no.
Constantly at him, time after time, to get him to sleep with her.
No.
I doubt that Helen really missed Jeffrey and wanted him to hold her and love her. That was just a game.
Jeffrey's had enough. He starts divorce proceedings.
He couldn't take it anymore. He really needed to get out of the relationship because Helen's controlling attitudes towards him just didn't allow him enough space to breathe.
She was outraged that Jeff wanted to leave. She just couldn't handle the fact that he was telling her it was over.
He offers Helen a financial settlement.
This is an insult.
It's a reasonable offer.
She was determined to get what she thought was her rightful share of the property.
I'm not settling for this.
But it's not enough for Helen.
I want 60% plus $1 million.
That's a total of something in the order of $1.6 million. And Jeffrey simply didn't have money anywhere near like that. There was no way he could even consider agreeing to it.
Helen has a plan to get what she wants. and it will be a family affair.
She didn't want half the money in a divorce. She wanted all the money. The only way to get that was his death.
In 2009, on a country property on the outskirts of Tamworth, Australia,
I'm very pleased with myself. You're doing
well. Helen Ryan invites her mother and sister over for a chat. But this is no polite tea party.
Ultimately, her goal was to sell off the property, get the money, remove Jeffrey altogether from her life.
Helen thinks her 40-year-old sister, Janine, holds the key to her freedom.
Janine was an escort, and she was also a drug user. She was a fairly weak personality, and Helen, I think, saw in her someone who she could manipulate very readily.
Janine knows plenty of tough guys. Helen wants one of them to kill her husband.
It literally took two phone calls. It was done.
Can I afford it?
But murder doesn't come cheap.
She had to provide $15,000 up front, otherwise it was no deal. Helen didn't have $15,000. She needed access to cash, and that's when she approached her mother, Coralie, to see if she could provide some of the funding to get Jeff dealt with.
Well, I'll give you 10.
70-year-old Coralie and her daughter, Janine, become willing accomplices.
Thanks, Coralie.
They didn't even ask any basic questions. They didn't question her. They didn't seek any detail. They just accepted, at face value, what she said.
Mother and daughters are now bonded to murder.
Helen was certainly the organiser. She instigated it. Coralie was the financier. Janine was the facilitator. She introduced the people that were going to carry it out.
On the evening of October 23rd, while Jeff finishes off farm chores, hired killer, 45-year-old Kenneth Brooks, is watching.
He knew, or must have known, exactly where Jeff would be. He made his way down the dirt road, carrying a 12-gauge shotgun.
It was premeditated, it was cold, calculated, and done for financial benefit.
Jeffrey died alone, bleeding to death into the soil that he worked. It was dark, it was cold, and even if he cried out, even if he had the strength to cry out, there was no one to hear him.
I don't know whether Helen killed Jeffrey for his money or because she was seeking revenge. But when there's $1 million involved,
I'm not settling for this.
I have to consider that the money was the big motivator of the murder.
When a neighbor finds Jeffrey's body the next morning, Helen is out running errands. She says she heard nothing the night before.
And yet, a farmer who lives a kilometer away said that he clearly heard the shots. The police wondered why Helen hadn't heard it when she was much closer.
Helen was smart enough to know that the very first person police would look at would be her. The spouse always has to be eliminated. That's one of the reasons she hired someone to kill him. The other reason is she's a coward.
But there is one witness Helen didn't count on. Jeffrey's friend from the factory tells the police about his marriage woes. Helen is now a suspect, and so is her family. The police tap Helen's phone.
With every passing day, there was a new reference to keeping together and telling the same story and making sure that the police didn't split them apart or pick holes in their story.
But Helen talks too much. She sets up a meeting with her hitman to make the final money drop. Instead, the police get their payday.
Helen Ryan, you're under arrest.
After their arrest, the three women make a pact to plead not guilty. But on the day of the trial, Janine, the weakest link, breaks. She betrays her mother and her sister.
Janine rolled over, pleaded guilty to conspiracy. That knocked out one corner of the triangle. And that was a big shock, I think, for Helen.
Helen misjudged her family. She thought she could trust them to keep their mouth shut about this. And she was wrong.
In October 2011, Janine Coulter is sentenced to 7 years, 4 months for conspiracy to commit murder.
Because Janine offered to give evidence and did give evidence, she got a discount.
Coralie Coulter is convicted of murder.
She won't be eligible for parole until she's nearly 90. So there is a reasonable prospect that she will die in jail.
The hired gunman, Kenneth Brooks, is sentenced to 38 years for murder. The mastermind, Helen Ryan, is convicted of murder and sentenced to a maximum of 36 years in prison.
Helen's murder of her husband, Jeffrey, wasn't personal. It was a family affair.
Helen Ryan condemns her husband's family to a life of grief and her family to a life in prison.
The most shocking part of this case is that someone could go to such lengths to manipulate other people into killing another human being.
When they wanted to kill, these women knew exactly who to ask. Denise Fry coaxed her teenage son to murder. Stephanie Hudnall used her daughter as a pawn in a lethal game. And Helen Ryan created a sisterhood of sin. These deadly women kept it all in the family with their killer kin.